Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. I understand that you actually did some work for one of our co-authors,
colleagues.
Co-contributors, mm-hmm. colleagues on Ascendo, Greg Hutchins, who writes and edits, has a number of different authors working with him on the CERM Insights, I think is the name of his article series. I should have looked that up. But he tends to talk about risk management. And so a couple months ago, he asked, you know, who is kind of the go-to, who knows their field really well? And he was looking for different disciplines, quality, reliability, all kinds of areas, and basically asking, what's the future of your discipline? And his take on a lot of these things is, you know, well, if you understand what the trends are, you may be able to spot the areas where there's a lot of friction, where there's going to be risks, either upside risks or downside risks. Where's the opportunities? But let's look ahead to see what we can expect so that we're not as surprised and or we can, you know, prepare for it or take advantage of it. And I understand he asked you to do a future of reliability. Engineering discipline, I think, is really what the topic was.
Yeah, it was. So just fascinating to even think about it. And I really appreciate Greg and another one of his websites. He's into so many different things.
Yeah.
Is the future professions.
Yep.
So that's really futureprofessions.com. And on that are just people from different disciplines talking about what the future is going to be. And of course, this is all ramping up because of the COVID-19 virus and how that's changed the way we do work. And so
something just the other day, just last night. I'm sorry to interrupt you on this one.
Sure, but that's fine.
Yeah, it was, you know, somebody was studying the correlation, and I don't know where they're getting data on this, but it was the relationship between if every day that we're not back in the office, the likelihood of certain professions, certain people, some percentage of the people not going back to the office. The longer we get comfortable working at home, and there's evidence that for some industries, some professions, you're actually more productive and you get more time at home. It's kind of a win-win for everybody. But there was a relationship between every week that we go with working at home, not in the office, the likelihood of that becoming the new normal or more accepted or just a bigger percentage of the population doing that naturally or normally is going up. And so they're like, yeah, this, you know, Omicron just gave us another, you know, 8 points of probability that 47% of people are not going back. And it came up with all kinds of weird numbers and percentages and everything. I was like, yeah, I'd really love to see the data on that one. But anyway.
Yeah. And what the assumptions are
that go
into that model. In fact, let's explore it for a minute within the context of the future topic. Mm-hmm. When Greg got in touch with me, he asked me to write an article on the future of work from a viewpoint of reliability engineering. And without going into the entire article, one part of it took up this subject of what can we do as reliability engineers from home versus in the office. Mm-hmm. And what I wrote about and what I thought about is human interactivity. We're humans, and we thrive on interactivity with other humans. And so we don't want to digitize everything to where there's no human interactivity. So I thought about, well, what is that human interactivity? And does it need to be in person? And what it comes down to for me, and I'm no expert in this subject, so I'd really love to have a conversation with people on it, is what it comes down to me is body language. When I'm with a person or with a group or a team, I can see their faces, I can see their hands, I can see and even as I'm talking, my hands are moving, mm-hmm. and you get emphasis with facial expressions or de-emphasizing things or scowls or frowns and smiles. And all of that is a nuance that adds to the communication. So much of communication is body language. And if you're set up working from home or you're interactive with people setup does not include a really good visual representation of the person you're talking to, so you can interact in a real way, then it's not going to be as meaningful. And just the other sideline to this is I've been noticing, see, when I teach virtually, I require the videos on with the students. Yep. I don't want that. And it's not because I'm some hard person that wants to, you know,
eyes on me. Yeah, I don't think you say that.
No, it's just the fact that I want to interact with people, and I so much want them to understand what I'm teaching that I want to be able to see that they get it. Not just they can tell me, yeah, I got it, or their body language might say something different.
Well, and I've seen you do this. It's like, you know, Jill, I get an idea sense here that maybe you've got a question. And she didn't raise her hand. She didn't do anything, but he was like, but that's body language. That's being there in person. And it's tougher over a camera because it's two dimensional. You don't see what's going on off screen. And it can be done, but it's harder. If you go audio only, then you got to be clever about making sure you hear voices more often and so on all the way down. If you're doing straight lecture, it's recorded. And then you get no feedback. You have to imagine all that. And it, of course, then gets more difficult. But you're exactly right. I'm wondering if that's a big part of what the metaverse type things. I don't know that an emoji little, you know, three-dimensional stick figure thing that's got my bad haircut is going to convey all of my facial gestures accurately.
Right. Oh, we've got so many things flashing through my mind right now, but
I can hear it in your voice.
That's right. The future of work is going to involve a certain amount of remoteness.
Yeah.
And it just is. And so this topic of this is where it comes into the topic of the future, is that we have to learn to interact both in person and remotely, because the answer is not going to be one or the other.
That's right.
It's going to be a combination. I've always taught that if you're going to do, for instance, a project remotely, it'd be really nice where the team could get together get to know each other. And so it might be worth the budget to have a travel to some site. You know, this is all post-COVID and everything, where people get to know each other and get to learn about what people's joys are and the things that give them passion, that they're passionate about. And then they can interact remotely a little bit easier.
Yeah. No, you used to see that with, the project kickoff would be a big get together. The whole team from around the world would all get together and we'd go through the details, the plans, the questions, but plenty of social interaction, plenty of time to just mingle and get to know each other. And that was by design, very much so. So at Hewlett Packard, it was a normal process to bring the team, because they're all over the world, bring them back into a single place. And usually it was for the project kickoff and initial planning and all that kind of stuff. And so the team and all the key decision players and key actors, stakeholders would, you know, work together, and there were different, you know, activities and all kinds of stuff that was real work and that needed to get done, with plenty of time to chat and talk to each other. And I'm not sure whether they discovered this on their own as they went more worldwide or they had some consultants tell them, but they found that it was worth it like 10x, because it just sped up the ability for the team to work together, because they had a shared experience that they could use as a touchstone to relate to each other. Now, in contrast to that, Tom Peters, remember Tom Peters? Different books he wrote some 30 years ago.
Books on Excellence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the things he saw as the future of work was this gig economy, where it was what he called the Hollywood model, right? So for a movie, the director gets together with, you know, art, you know, cinematographer and the script writers and all the different camera crews and the staff. And they're all put together. They all have their individual expertise and backgrounds and training. And, you know, Jill and Joe are available. So they put them on the team and they really want to work with this, you know, associate producer. So they get that one online. They drag her off for other project. They come together for the project. They work together for a year or 2 years. Some movies longer. And then the movie gets finished and they all disperse and they go on work on other projects. Now, it's a gig economy, right? And so what we're seeing more and more, and I heard about it on a newscast last night or a financial podcast yesterday, last night, was that that's coming true, that more and more people are working where I'm a project manager. I can work on this and this and this and this, and I get together with this team, we do the project, and then I go look for the next project. You know, and I might not have the same electrical engineers working with me. I might have different marketing people working with me. But even within the company, people are putting together teams and they're dispersing. And more people are freelancing and they're joining a project. They work on it for a while and then they go work on something else.
Yeah, that is definitely part of the future is the... And he called it the gig economy, and it can also be called contractors. And there's just a way to look at the question is, who does somebody work for? In other words, who pays the payroll? Mm-hmm. And you're seeing more and more companies decentralize is the word I'm looking for, where they use suppliers, use contractors, that type of thing, as opposed to everybody being on the W-2 payroll of the company.
Right.
So that's certainly a trend. As any trend, there are pros and cons, and that's really the thing we have to keep in mind when we talk about the future. You talk about the future of remote work. Well, there can be pros, there can be cons on that. And same with the gig economy. There can be pros and cons. One of the cons is the contractor's not necessarily part of the team esprit de corps. And so you have to bring the gig workers sort of and bring them in, create the team effect, because teams are so important and the enjoyment and the interactivity is really high. So you have to be good at that to integrate contractors.
See, I don't know. I guess I've been a consultant for way too long. It's, you know, part of it is if you've got the right group of experts that bring their best to the group, to the team, it's with the spirit of we need to make this work. And that means we need, you know, we all succeed when this project succeeds. Unlike my voice. But yes. The idea is that if I'm only there to get my paycheck and punch the clock, the opportunity for that group to succeed is diminished. And I see that whether people are on the payroll or not, but if the Hollywood model is based on everybody comes to the group and we know that the movie will be successful if we all do our best work, and our best work includes working with other people and all the other aspects of it is working well. And yes, I think you can get that esprit part, but I don't think that's I tell as to what I think it's a pro and con on either model, because you can have deadwood inside work. One of the things though that I think is an issue, and I think it's related to reliability more so, is different people when they say, hey, we need a reliability engineer, or we need to look at this from a reliability point of view, or we're trying to achieve this particular level of reliability, the ability to have a common language about what does that actually mean that's what keeps you and I busy so much as consultants, is helping teams understand what they're actually trying to achieve. Is when the movie goes out on April 1st, there's a clean vision of what that is from one person, the directors, and this is what we want to do. But when we go into a program building a widget, and we know we want it to be reliable, we want it to be more reliable than our competitors. Well, how reliable is your competitor's product? Well, we don't know.
Yes.
Right? So I think part of the downside from a reliability point of view is that if you're getting hired by somebody or brought into a program and they expect you just to do parts count prediction, and they think that's what reliability is all about, they just need a number for the data sheet. And you're coming in with the expectation that you get to work with the team to actually create something that meets their objective. Well, there's a problem there. Right. And if you're on the team on a regular basis and you're working with a set of people routinely, that bit of communication and bit out of understanding gets in sync and you can make that work. But as you transition from one program to the next, what I'm finding is that oftentimes in industry, we don't have this universal understanding of what reliability is or how you get it or what does it mean to have a reliability engineer on the team. It's so many different expectations. And I think that's part of the downside, because you and I often talk about it's the culture of that team, of that organization. In the gig economy and pulling people together for one project and dispersing, well, then the culture changes as those elements change, unless there's a common understanding across the whole team of what it is that reliability is about. And I don't think that's there yet.
No, I hear what you're saying. When I wrote this article, which, by the way, I'm going to also publish on Ascend of Reliability, the future of reliability engineering. One of the stories that I tell that fits into what you're talking about is when I started out as a reliability manager, prior to that, the reliability engineers did mostly parts counts and reliability allocation, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And I knew that the trend needed to change. It was a long-term trend that we're going to need to start shifting to designing and reliability. And that's not going to be a large group of reliability engineers that sit around and design in reliability.
Right.
That's the engineering team. So the whole subject of teams was important, and reliability engineers I knew needed to change their focus. So the story went something like this: is when I took on the job as supervisor or manager of reliability, one of the things you do is you talk to people about what their objectives are, mm-hmm. what their career is going to be, what are they going to be doing this year and next year. And I remember it sort of blurted out with the reliability engineer I was talking to, the young person. And I said, really, what you want to do is you want to work yourself out of a job, I told them.
Yeah.
And in other words, you don't want to do reliability. You want to support people to engineer reliability into the products. And you sort of back yourself out of the work. And then the person looked quizzical at me, and I had to explain it a little more. But the whole concept is the long-term trend that we are getting into, and it just continues, and it's been going on for decades, is to move away from the model where there's a group of people that do reliability to reliability engineers that are more like consultants. And yes, they can do statistics, and yes, they can do certain methods, but they also have to influence and help people make good decisions and help engineers, people outside of reliability, in management and in engineering, do the work to bring about reliability. And that's a different concept, and that's going to be part of the future, I think, for a long time.
Yeah, well, I mean, you and I have both seen this in the works for years and years and years, and so one of the things that disturbs me, though, is somebody posted on LinkedIn the other day an article about, hey, we need to stop using MTBF, which I thought was brilliant and supportive.
Wow, what a great idea.
And even did a shout out and a link to the No MTBF site, which was great. Mm-hmm. And so by the time I got copied on this thing and alerted to it, it had 40 comments already. It was just and a lot of support. Mostly it was all good stuff. Yet one of the comments really stuck with me, and it's part of the friction to get to this future of reliability, where there's a understanding and focus on the reliability engineer doesn't create the reliability that exists in your product or system. It's the rest of the organization that does that. Because their comment was, Well, the reliability engineers we hire, they only know how to calculate MTBF. It's in all the books. It's on all the courses. That's all they know how to do. And
hiring
so,
from the wrong place.
Yeah. Well, if that's all you expect them to do, then it becomes this vicious circle that you end up, that's all you get. And I think they were highlighting that the structure of education, the structure of how you become a reliability engineer, where we get our professional development, hasn't broken that cycle yet and got us out of the late 60s.
Yeah.
You know, kind of.
It's a long-term trend. And really, in my experience as a manager where I've hired reliability engineers, I've done a balance. I've done both. I've hired many people from like University of Maryland Kell's group. Mm-hmm. I've also hired many people that are not reliability people, yeah, that were design engineers, manufacturing engineers, and then had taught them reliability engineering because mm-hmm. they with the idea they would then support the designing in. And I've done both models, and both work. And I think there's mm-hmm. a balance there. Well, one thing I wanted to throw in there before we end off on the podcast on this topic on the future, because we could do part two of this and part three.
Yeah.
But I just want to bring up the subject of models, because in the future, there's going to be more and more need to products are more and more complex, and there's more and more need to incorporate modeling and models, not just reliability models, but models for engineering, model-based engineering, where the engineering is done based on models, and then the performance can be estimated and calculated and fine-tuned and optimized. And then reliability will need to interact better and better with the future model-based engineering techniques. And that's just a topic we're going to be growing and growing on. This is how do we work together on this? And the comment I want to make is the assumptions in the models, both from the reliability side and the engineering, general engineering side, are so important that we don't forget the remember the pros and cons.
Yep.
There's cons to models,
yep,
and the cons have to do with the wrong assumptions.
Yep.
We always have to keep that in mind.
Well, models are getting way, way better. I remember the first time I saw finite element analysis, there were so many assumptions so that you could get a result this week that it was little better than looking at a diving board for material flux. It was, well, why don't we just go out and look at a diving board? You've oversimplified this so much that we've got no twist. We know that it twists, and you're only doing the single bend moment. Well, that's all the model can do. So that's what we have to use. Like, no, let's not use that. Let's go build some platforms and go measure it. To today, we can use the models to see things that we didn't anticipate at all. And then we can go back to the, to the lab and confirm or, sort that out and get in. It's so interactive. And I think the assumptions is a piece of that. The other big piece, and this might be episode 8, 9, and 10, is it's got to include the failure mechanisms and the factors that influence those failure mechanisms.
Exactly.
And there's so many tools that can do that, and then they get ignored by the designers. We want nominal. Every component is going to be perfect. Every screw is torqued to perfect, and all this stuff. I'm like, well, what happens if that's loose and that's off? And this is, well, I can do that. Well, do it. Well, then it doesn't work. And then I show them the manufacturing data that says the variability is 3 times what you're assuming it is, even when it doesn't work. So we got a problem here. That's
exactly
what I mean, using these models well, but also with that bit of influence. Maybe people could be more...
Great comment. We have to go... So my comment on the assumptions needs to expand to include, obviously, the failure mechanisms that go into the models. They have to be the right ones and the right types of modeling of the mechanisms in it as part of the engineering models that are part of model-based engineering.
Yeah.
No,
there's lots of cool new stuff coming up. There's lots of new things, but it's really doing the fundamentals and the basics and understanding our role and how that role is evolving, and the challenges of, the gig economy and jumping from one team to the next and trying to reinforce the cultures and all the stuff we talked about. And I think, Carl, we do have to have like a part 7, 8, 9, 12.
We probably do. If you're a listener and you have some ideas and thoughts about the future of our profession, future reliability engineering, reliability management, or quality fields, we'd love to hear from you because, like Fred said, this is going to be part two, part three, and on that we need to talk about.
Yep. And you can do that over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And there's a place there you can, or a widget there that allows you to record a message to us, or you can leave a written message. You can find Carl and I and the other hosts of the show on LinkedIn or on our about pages on the site. Plenty of ways for you to join the conversation.
Very good. All nice right. conversation, Fred.
Yeah, thanks. I'm going to have to write a bunch of notes here about
have to go contemplate the future a little bit.
Well, I'm just working for my next cup of coffee, so keep it close and doable at the moment. All right, talk to you later, Carl.
See you later, Fred.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.